You're listening to Economics of Place, part of the We Love Where You Live podcast series brought to you by the Michigan Municipal League. Here's your host, Dan Gilmartin.
Welcome back to the Economics of Place podcast. I'm Dan Gilmartin, and I'm now joined by Dr. Cindy Fruin, who is a architect and an urban futurist. Dr. Fruin consults, speaks, and writes on urbanization, future cities, and design futures, and she specializes in the intersection of people, technology, and environment. Welcome to the podcast.
Well, thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
Great. So we're sitting right now in downtown Detroit, actually in Midtown Detroit. And Dr. Fruin just got done speaking to a group of about 60 leaders in cities throughout the state of Michigan about some of the big changes she sees happening in cities, not just here, but around the world, as we move forward in trying to get people to think about that rather than simply sort of get through the day and keep the doors open and the lights on. There's a lot of things changing, and that's really your specialty.
Right. That's right. So,
yeah. So tell us a little bit about that. What do people want to know about the next 20 years, the next 50 years? What do you want to give them in terms of telling them about what they need to be thinking about, at least?
So I looked at two different things. One is the outside trends, and the other is the role that people play in it. So you just mentioned the idea that people have to kind of keep their nose to the grindstone to produce today. That's right. What we call first horizon thinkers. And those are the people that pay the bills. That's right. What I did for years and years as an architect in Kansas City is that I was, you know, running a company and doing building by building and then doing district by district. But it was very much nose to the grindstone, producing on today's ideas. But then three horizon scenarios, you think about people that are dreamers. The third horizon is far out. And the strategists are the people in between that make that glue the vision, the far out blue ocean kind of strategy thinking with today's producers. So that's the horizon two people. Okay. But then if you're looking far out, you have to think about trends as well as this agency, this leadership that has to come to make change and use the trends. And in the trends, I think in terms of population changes, environmental changes, and technological. And each one of those have got very dramatic changes in this century.
So, yeah, with your three horizons, we were talking a little bit about NASA and before this, because you have a lot of experience in Houston. And I think of your description, I think of the space race. So, you know, you've got a bunch of really important and really thoughtful engineers working sort of day to day. Early 1960s, President Kennedy says, we're going to the moon, right? That's probably that third level. And then everybody figuring out how we're actually going to get there are the horizon two thinkers of, okay, that's the big goal. How do we get there?
Yeah.
Is that kind
yeah.
of the,
does that well, make the sense? Other so, people were busy working for Boeing or somebody building airplanes for today. Right.
Right.
And so you have the NASA people in between gluing together the big picture thinking from Kennedy. And I mentioned that it's important that they have this vision, right. They have that leadership. But they also had the urgency that the Russians were giving us.
Yeah.
And the urgency was that they were beating us, right? The cosmonauts were out there and they were going to get to the moon first. And that would be, you know, shame on our face that we had this technology, but we didn't act on it. And so President Kennedy said, we will act on it and we're going to do it by the end of this. Sure enough, by 1969, we were on the moon.
Yeah. And I think, you know, it also lends itself, and we may as well stay with the analogy here while we're on it, but that whole 10-year period brought about so much in the way of technological advancements. If I remember my history correctly, there were only three individuals on that mission. So only three people actually went to the moon, but everybody else in society got all sorts of things, like Tang, right? That came from that? Sorry.
Microwaves,
all kinds of different advancements that you learn along the way and you bring to people. And I think you see that with all sort of technological advances that are right. sort of started with that big picture thinking.
Right. Yeah.
Great. So what if I'm a city official, if I'm thinking about my neighborhood, if I'm thinking about my community, whether it's a place like right now, as we sit here in Midtown Detroit, or if I'm a smaller town of 10 or 20,000 people, what would you like them to be thinking about? Sort of top of mind about the next, well, first of all, let me say, do you want them to think about the next 10 years, the next 50, the next 100?
Yeah. And so I like people to think beyond where they normally do. Because when you're doing planning, and it usually comes with population and transportation issues, infrastructure issues in city planning. And though, and of course, land use and marketing that would go with that. But when we think in terms of 20 and 25 years, we always just extend the present. We just think of it as today, only faster, better, smarter. We just extend to where we are.
Be business, a little bit wider.
Business, you know, as usual. Yeah. And thinking usually always in terms of growth. When you do that, you can really miss the big picture. So what I encourage people to do is look at 50 or even 100-year plans. Because 100 years is not that long when you think about people living, half the people that are born today being living for 100 years. Right. If we can live that long, why can't we build our cities for that long? Yeah. That we are considering out 4 or 5 generations ahead. And the reason that you would do that is so that you're not building cities that are for the past, but that are for those future generations.
Yeah. In your talk, you talked about 2100, and many of the climate projections have a city like Detroit actually in 2100 will be experiencing a climate comparable to modern day Houston. Which is 100-degree summers and 60-degree winters, as opposed to what we are right now. And that's something that would obviously completely change not just the look and feel of a place like this, but the economy and everything that goes along with it.
Well, no more ice fishing, right?
Right.
They don't ice fish in Houston. That
no,
could
they
be
don't.
One of the headings
no
here.
No more downhill skiing. yeah, I mean, it's really an amazing thing to think about, and I do think that's important. You think of things, you know, 1,000 years into the future, but much of this technology advancement and much of the climate change and some of the other things that we're all dealing with is happening much, much faster as we go along. So you like people to think longer term. What are some of the things you want people to be thinking about? If they just said, hey, where should my head be when I pick my nose up out of the debits and credits book and try to figure out what we're all going to look like in 20 years or whatever.
So we talk about demographics and population change. And in America anyway, our fertility rates are down to the level that we basically barely replace ourselves. And people are living longer. So you get older population and aging ends up being a really critical thing because the way that you build a city for a person who's 80 or 90 versus a person that's 5 or 10.
Right.
Very different kinds of cities.
Right.
And if in...
And with limited resources too, right? I mean, if you're taking care of all your elderly, how are you paying for education?
Always.
Everything.
Because in fact, they're probably not producing money. They are not a productive side. They're literally a group that depends on other generations to support them. And so... And they've earned it, right? And so
there's
a sense of needing to do that well and making that a beautiful time of your life. And how do you make that really welcoming? At the same time, you have to think wide. You have to think in terms of, we call it in foresight thinking, steep domains, which is social, technological, environmental, economic, and political. And then in terms of the cultural values of the place, the history of the place, so that you frame it accordingly, according to the things that are important to the people, the things that are important to the environment there. Every place is unique and different. And you have to take account of that at the same time that you're looking at this larger, longer term picture and looking across all those domains. Most of the time when we look ahead, we may look at environment, we may look at population, and we may even look at technology, but we don't connect all the dots. And so the one thing they really have to think about is how things connect, because it's a complex world. Everything affects everything else. You can't do just one thing. You knock this ball and that one moves.
Right.
And it's an emerging future. It's emerging change as opposed to planned change that we used to do in the 1900s.
Yeah, I know. It's so amazing to think about that because we all have a tendency to sit down and go through long planning programs and write big fancy reports and say, here's how the world's going to look. And it just rarely ends up that way.
The least likely scenario is business as usual. Yeah. That business, if you're just doing extended present, faster, better, smarter, then it's probably unlikely.
Certainly. So demographic changes you mentioned, what does it look like in a Midwestern state like Michigan? We've been hovering about 9.5 to 10 million people for the last 40 years, really. There hasn't been a lot of big change in demographics in terms of the number of people living here. During that same time, we've gone from a relatively affluent state to a relatively poor one, with manufacturing going the other way. So we've sort of got the same amount of people we had 40 years ago, and now they're relatively worse off than they were. And a lot of Midwestern states look like that, right? And it's not everywhere. There are some places that are growing, but in terms of the aggregate at the state level, do you see that changing in terms of how maybe the industrial Midwest looks moving forward, especially with climate not being... Many of the states here are much better from a climate perspective than the Southwest or the Southeast or some other spots, or continuing on as it is.
Well, it's two or three things that interconnect on that thinking. And one of them is that how do you deal with long-term poverty mm-hmm. And climate change and technological changes? And how can you take advantage of the, you know, theoretical innovation? It does look like we're innovating.
Right.
At the same time that you, as you mentioned, you have the same number of people, but they just have less resources.
Right.
And so that means you have to do more with less. So number one is digital future is your friend, because digital is infinite. Unlike real estate costs lots of money, and the less of it that there is, the more densities that you have, the more expensive it is, and all the prices go up. And even though all of these things have been harmful for people that are not making as much money while all the expenses are going up. Right. It's just been a rub from every side. So how do you try to make that? Well, one of the areas would be in learning, relearning new kinds of jobs and education. Here you have a really vast resources in both health and education. These are your two very strong areas. And how do you parlay that into a future that right. gives people new jobs, new education, but a far less resources? Well, one way is like this, digital,
yeah,
right?
Digital,
how,
for sure.
This is how you spread information without having to fly people in all the time, but without having to everybody go to the same place. And that world is getting better and better and better.
Right. I think you mentioned growth. Let's go back to that for a second, because I've seen a lot of people argue that true growth is not necessarily advancement. And when you talk about business growth, you're not talking about the growth of people. And I noticed you had a lot of people-centric wording in your report is sort of at the focus of what you would like to see in terms of developing communities. And I've come to a similar conclusion. We do a lot of work in placemaking, and everyone's always saying, what is the definition? Everyone's got something different. With me, it's always as simple. It's improving the human experience,
yeah.
Right? I mean, you kind of know it when you see it.
That's
right?
A good one.
Maybe it's an interesting area like we're in right now. You feel the energy going on in these yeah. tech hubs, or it's great architecture, or it's walkability, yeah. whatever it might be. But it's just making your life just a little bit better than it was yesterday, if you will. And mm-hmm. and I think, you know, today most of the growth that we have seen in the United States in general has been around sort of the financial markets, mm-hmm. right? The innovation's been in the financial markets yeah. over the last 20, 30, 40 years.
Scary.
As opposed to, you know, developing the next whatever. And so I sometimes worry about that. Even people, the entrepreneurs, they're not looking to build the next large corporation. They're looking to get into something for 5 or 10 years, sell it for a bunch of money, and get out, which is mm-hmm. different in terms of what it might look like for a city, for a region as we move forward. Am I worried too much on that stuff, or is it just sort of part of a bigger picture of how we innovate? Are we innovating differently in that respect? Or
so that is this individualism that we have in America, right? Is that we and innovation fits right into that model, is that it's an entrepreneurism, is that you are your own ship, your own star in a constellation of right. larger group,
right.
but that you would have a lot more jobs than you ever had before. And it's a whole adaptive environment in the work environment. Instead of working for one place or getting a pension,
right.
you're in it for yourself. And at the same time, though, younger generations are very interested in the social impact that they have. They say they'd rather have a job that matters they'd rather be out of work than have a job that yes. doesn't matter to them. So it's really important to them to be doing work that matters.
And from a city perspective, we know they choose where they want to live first, and then they figure the job out later.
There you
because
go.
That's more important to them. And plus, economies, jobs, whole industries are now mobile. So if they want to be somewhere, they go. And that's why you see young people still collecting in Portland, even though the underemployment in Portland is just ridiculous. You got lots of MBAs tending bar, but they want to be there. Yeah. And we see that, so it kind of makes your point too.
And you want that. I mean, you want to be that place.
Right.
And it could be that as you warm up, that it does seem as though Americans like to go to warmer places. And there's a popular science image. I don't know if you've seen this. They had a couple of years ago, they put out this image of the country, and every part of the country, little by little, they wiped out the whole regions. Like they said, the West is no good because of wildfire and pollutions. The South is no good because they're going to have hurricanes and flooding. The East is going to have hurricanes and flooding too. Right. And little by little, and the Midwest, largely droughts and heat. And the only place worth living would be Michigan.
All right. Sounds good.
So there's a little video on that. You can look it up.
Real estate, I guess. That's what you're saying. For my children in 50 years or something.
No, this is like the upside of global warming sort of thinking.
Yeah, well, you know, and quite frankly, we're going to be discussing that in the series that you helped kick us off today, our public policy series where we're looking at the future of cities, actually. And those climate refugees that were referenced early on, they used to call them halfbacks, where people left states like Michigan, went to Florida, experienced a hurricane or two, and came halfway back to places like Tennessee or North Carolina.
Oh, so they're a halfback.
And now they're sort of coming all the way back or not going in the first place. We see people retiring differently. And I know we look at community life and we talk about making communities culturally significant for people and recreational opportunities and walkability and all the things that we know that young people are looking for. Actually, retiring boomers are looking for similar things.
Yeah,
you know, their Saturday nights probably look different.
Yeah,
but in terms of what they want, it's different. So, I mean, I'm not sure people are going to be retiring on, you know, in Arizona on 10 golf courses or something like that, like the way we've been doing for 20 or 30 years.
So I like to say there's three kinds of buildings left. And there's buildings that we love, and we're going to upkeep them because they're so beautiful. You know, you aren't going to tear down certain buildings. We're going to keep them. They're our monuments. They're our history.
Right.
There's buildings we can adapt and reuse because they're going to be used for very different things. They're going to have to be mixed use. They're going to have to be smart. They're going to have be self-sufficient. I think cities are going to become self-sufficient instead of being stuck on a grid that they're bringing in their electricity from halfway across the planet.
Right.
They're literally going to be able to have distributed energy that is developed right there, and
right.
that they aren't dependent on that outside world. And same thing with water, and same thing with food, is that we end up with a much more localized economy that helps cities become self-reliant.
Yeah.
So they are connected in social and economic terms, but they're not necessarily connected in these resources because of the problems that come up with that. I mean, it does make a city vulnerable when they are so dependent on this larger grid or on this larger resources that may or may not keep coming.
Yeah, that's for sure. And I mean, that was one of the things I wanted to talk to you about, and you just sort of answered that. But my instincts and what I've seen in research and what I've actually experienced, I was just in Copenhagen last week and even some
a great
of this,
place.
Great place and doing things a lot differently than we do them here.
I do.
But even some cities, regions.
By choice. It was intentional.
Absolutely.
They said, we're congested. They happen to have this really brilliant guy named Yongel. I'm saying his name really wrong.
And close. Giel, I think.
Giel. And who was all about human-centered cities.
Absolutely.
And so he said, oh, it's congested, and what are we going to do, make it walkable and bikeable? Now, they're lucky they have the landscape, the elevation of, like, Florida, flat,
right.
which for biking is really useful, as opposed to when you have a real hilly environment, it makes it much more difficult.
Pittsburgh or somewhere.
Yeah, it's much more, you know, you've got to have some serious thigh muscles to deal with some of those. So, well, you can always put a little engine on there, right? A little motor.
Right. That's kind of cheating over there, though. I don't see a lot of birds either.
No, I don't think they're doing that.
It's part of the ethic. You get on your bike. But again, you know, what we see there and we see in other places are the way to combat, if you will, and combat's probably the wrong word, but the way to thrive maybe in globalization, or what some people are calling post-globalization, which I think is a little bit early for that. But the way to thrive in many cases, and it's not intuitive, is to be hyper-local, you know, and you know, as you're mentioning, not be reliant upon everything else. You know, the days of the 3,000-mile Caesar salad, you know, being made in Napa Valley and shipped to a restaurant or to a supermarket in your hometown. It just
sounds wrong, doesn't it?
Yeah,
it just
sounds
seems
wrong. And it is wrong.
Yeah.
And so,
yeah, why do it when you can? When you can grow it on your own balcony, for goodness sakes.
Right.
You know, you don't really have to, it's better, it's fresher, it's
all
got
the
less chemicals,
stuff, absolutely.
All of that.
It's all good.
And so we really got ourselves hooked on a model that was broken. And we're having to repair it. We're in transition. I think that gives people a place of disruption, a place where they can transition to what they want as opposed to what they just took by automatic. They had just done because this is how things were done, but yeah. Doesn't mean that it was done the best way. They need to rethink all those things.
So is that an indictment of big box retail?
You know, we're going to miss our big box retail. That's what I think. I think we're going to miss those big box retail.
Which means they're going away, you think?
Well, what do you think? Yeah, that's all I can say is watching Walmart go online. What do you think?
Yeah.
And they're kind of the king of retail.
Why do you think we're going to miss it? Just
because we can't go down there and buy things. Because the little drones are delivering them to our doorstop. And so, we lived that way, and there still be local. There still will be local, but you can't see that it will be as supported as it has been. Yeah. I mean, you can't see that has the same. There's a certain demographic that may continue doing that, but there's probably a lot of them that won't because they don't have. It takes them less time. They can do it on their own time. Yeah. They, they can put things on auto order. Sure. They don't even never have to do it again. I mean, look how quickly we got away from writing checks. We were happy to quit writing checks, right? Well, I write two checks a month. That's great, because you just let it all be done automated.
Money in general.
I mean, yeah. I had one of my family members.
$20 in my pocket because you don't need it.
That's right.
Easier without it.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Money and that whole financial just really changed from when we were kids.
Well, and I think to get back to sort of the city leaders aspect of things, you can look at something from sort of a Wall Street Journal perspective and try to figure out what Walmart stock might look like or something along those lines or how it might change supply chains or those types of things. But, I'm thinking back to like the 80s and 90s, all the teen movies that were set in malls. It was just like where kids expected to be. I mean, everybody worked at the mall. Everybody went to the mall. It was the gathering place. I remember those days a little bit. And that was
knowing
the spot
that we
to
quit
be.
Building malls in the 70s.
Right. But I mean, we sort of turned our backs on historic downtowns and said, we're going to go to the mall and the kids are going to hang out at the mall. And that lasted 20 years or something. Yeah. I don't really know. But now we're sort of moving away from that. So there's this whole social aspect of how we change and how we do things a little bit differently. And if you're an architect, if you're a city planner, if you're an elected official, you need to be thinking about that because that sort of how people run into each other, the exchanges they have, where they gather.
Yeah, Mumford said that's what cities are for, is for all the chance intersections that you meet somebody.
And those
encounters,
those are changing
that's
again,
all
right?
It's about. How do you get those encounters? And so there will, they call it the third place. The other places that you go because it's by choice, the coffee shops and the bowling alley, not that. I say bowling alley because of that whole famous study of bowling alone.
Bowling alone, right.
And so it comes to mind when I think about social third places.
Right.
But how do these, there's also this idea of a jobless future too. And so it's not just the retail that's at risk. It's the offices that are at risk. Mm-hmm. And even the single family housing. I mean, I think it's Minnesota that got rid of their idea of a single family house that you can, and you have to think it wasn't that many years that you could have a carriage house out back. Why did that ever go away anyway?
Right.
And so it's not that, let's say innovative, but it was shocking, wasn't it?
It was
shocking. And so but why?
Right.
It was only a couple of generations ago that was normal.
Well, I live in an old historic, Victorian neighborhood with adjacent to a historic downtown with a business strip, and there are very few carriage houses, and they would be perfect for that area. And
use your land. I mean, it's your land. Why are you
not
using it?
But it's like going back to people are freaked out, and that's a 5 or 10 year process because they're, oh my God, what's going to happen? Mm-hmm. Who's going to live there? It's like, well, that's where people want to live, and they'll put people on the street, and the downtown will be healthier, and there'll be more growth, and it will provide affordable housing or spots for granny flats or whatever, but we've decided that's evil, and now it's we got to come back on that one, which is a lot of things, right? The sea line setbacks and everything that we sort of like. I talk to people and I say, if we ask where the best 10 cities in Michigan were, there's consensus pretty quick. There's some cool architecture and some energy on the streets, maybe some water or something. There's stuff to do. And yet most of that stuff's illegal back home. We live on the side of 8-lane roads and, single family lots and quarter acre lots. And
yeah,
and
we got a little too pristine, didn't we? We got a little too pure. And that's true about so many things of the industrial era, is that we assumed single uses.
Yep.
And the single uses turned out to be almost inhumane. Is that they might have worked really effectively for making short-term profits, but they don't really work for making long-term communities and good places to live, because it forces you into this whole lifestyle of commuting just to go to the grocery store.
Right.
Everything is a commute. It doesn't matter what it is. You got to probably get in your car in most neighborhoods, not everywhere. And people are seeing that benefit. And especially as they're aging and seeing how difficult it is to get in their car and go places, why don't they walk, and then they're healthier and they're going to live longer.
Right. And but you, when you think that's so easy, then you start peeling back the onion, right? And you see, you know, how banks are funding home underwriting loans. It's
banks
easy to get
insurance,
one
yeah.
on a 3,000 foot home in the suburbs, but not to loft a building out in the city.
That's right.
It's a, you know, 6-month project. And
right.
And so, you know, it follows its way through in terms of how we regulate it, how business looks at it.
Yeah, insurance and banking really are, have been cornerstones of difficult to find the innovation in those areas, which opens up the door for other people that are willing to take the risk. And that's where you get into blockchain thinking. I mean, there's you know, group funding. There's different ways that people are looking at how do you finance these projects. And it's a risk for anybody that's not willing to change. Okay. There's a big high risk for people that are just stuck in doing single use.
It is, for sure. For sure. So let's take the last couple minutes here and talk. We'll play a little stump the band here, if I will. What's something you wish, you talk to groups like ours a lot and work with them and consult with them, what's something you wish people were paying more attention to right now that's going to be affecting cities, people's lives a lot more than they think in the near future, whatever that is?
Well, you kind of sound like you're hinting at technology, but you know, I'm going to say this is the issue of getting rid of the fragmentation and the whole city thinking, because nobody thinks across borders and across domains.
Sort of discipline specific.
Everything has been
public safety.
Everything is siloed. Right. Everything is separated in a matrix form, and you do your box. I really think the only way you can, and community members, people that are not experts like us, people that are not versed in that, they think in terms of whole cities. It's us that's got the break. Right. We're the ones that need to break our brains and change this segmentation and the way that we talk about things and the way that we do things. Now, that means there has to be some translators, basically communication translators that can go between these. And again, we get down to those H2 people that can do the current production of things, can understand what we had and the things that we might have, and how do you merge, how do you marry the two? And I think anybody in these leadership roles have got to be able to marry the old and the future, or they're just not building things that are going to last very long.
Yeah.
And they better be ready to tear them down. You may as well start thinking about that. Because that is a third kind. I said there's the beloved buildings, there's the adaptive buildings, and there's the forgotten ones that have to be destroyed. Right. And when you have limited resources and limited people, unlike what we had in the last century, where it seemed that, you know, fat and fatter,
right,
is that we, you have to start making hard choices that way. You know, buildings are not people. They do get torn down. I mean, they get destroyed.
Yeah, I think some of them, as you said, had that cultural significance, whether it be a type of architecture or somewhere, the gathering place or whatever, and other ways that we've got to look at things a little bit differently.
It's very hard. Yeah. I mean, look how many decades it's taken to get all those green lots I see here in Detroit. There's a whole lot of green lots. Oh, yeah. One of the most sad blocks I saw had one house over here, one house over here, everything else torn down, and both of them were fairly pristine, you know? Yeah. They were really going for it. But they had lost all their neighbors.
Right.
And the next block had many more buildings that hadn't been torn down, houses that hadn't been torn down yet. And so they were more derelict that way. But their future will be that same snaggletooth look.
Right.
What is the future
teeth,
there?
We call it
on
a block for sure. How about an industry that is going to maybe pop up, or one that's going to go away?
Healthcare is just the thing. You have got to see health in the future. But also, more than the way that we treated health as a science. And health is about well-being. It's about being healthy,
right,
as opposed to health care. And so being healthy is a very different, you know, whole body. We did this whole, you know, Euclidean geometry combined with Descartes mind body as though they were separate things. They're not
with
separate.
A little Moses
we're
in there
we're
too.
Like we're like huge. We're whole people.
The...
Yeah, you know, yeah. He was really good at that. He saw, you know, a line on the on there and out go, you know, thousands of people's homes.
Yeah.
And how do you then bring back that? And Jane Jacobs was ahead of her time that way, right? She saw immediately that her little beloved neighborhood was going to get wiped out by one of these. If they just missed the line a little bit, her house would be gone or something.
Yeah.
Is that she was brilliant that way. But
absolutely,
that was the
60s. Yeah.
And so that was the era of urban renewals. And there was a belief that you tear down to build up new all the time.
And that
again,
didn't work so well.
Again, single-use thinking is that they thought their era Silver was bullet. The only era
right.
that mattered, as opposed to how cities really are done, which is by millions and millions of actions by millions and millions of people over generations.
Yes, for sure. And that's one thing that's interesting, too, because if you think in terms of a Darwinian effect, cities, which were here before farms, right? People got together for purposes of safety and food and everything else. And we sort of had this Darwinian concept over millions of years where we came up with these sort of walkable nodes within larger places with commercial. And then all of a sudden the car came along. And we said, you know what? We're going to change everything.
Yeah.
And we changed it all.
Yeah, we did.
And it didn't work very well.
Yeah.
And now we're kind of looking to change it back.
Paying a price,
which is a
very
interesting thing to do with that.
Well, and that ends up being part of the history now, is that you can't really change it back, but it's going to be something different. It's going to be these, you know, probably these network nodes kinds of regions. I mean, some of these cities are looking at over 100 million people.
Yeah, which is astonishing.
100 million. Right. Yet, even though those mega cities are growing so huge, most people will still live in cities that are much more reasonably sized.
Right.
Those are still only going to be, you know, 30 or 40 of them. But still, 100 million people.
That's insane.
It.
I was in a town called Wuhan, China last year, which I'd never heard of until I was going to go there. It's 10 million people. And in the next decade and a half, they're going to drop another 7 million people into it. So they're going to, it's already 10 million people, and they're going to drop basically the population of New York City into this single place.
New York City proper.
Yes.
Not New York City metro.
Right. It's crazy. But again, you see that happening in different spots, and that just brings about all sorts of change, which is for sure. So let me step back a little bit to health. You talked about that. And I know I spoke to a group a few weeks ago and looked at the happiness quotients and people trying to figure out happiness.
Yeah.
And the three things that come out on top for why someone would be happy is a stable family life, stable home life, is a sense of worth within an economy. So a relative level of
confidence,
equalization, if you will, within
fairness.
Economy.
It's a fairness,
fairness
issue.
Thing, absolutely. And then strong mental health was three. And so I was challenging local officials. It's like none of those things really fit into your city budget, but that's what's going to make people happy in your community.
Mm-hmm.
And so if we're about, again, trying to create places that are sticky, that people want to be in, you know, how are you thinking about that? I mean, is that kind of how we're getting to what you're talking about in terms of healthcare? It's not just the flu shot. It's not just the cancer clinic or whatever. It's more about sort of a holistic way in which people can reside happily.
Yeah.
Or is that, am I going too far with
no,
that?
No, that's exactly right. So in the 80s, San Luis Obispo in California had an architect who was a planner, went through planning commission and ended up as mayor. And he said, we're not going to become one of those other suburban-like cities,
right,
the drive-through cities. We're going to eliminate drive-through restaurants. We're going to eliminate big box retail. We're going to make these paths. They had this little ditch behind the Main Street area, and instead they beautified it, kind of like San Antonio did. You know, they made a little waterway area through there.
Yeah.
And all of the businesses along there were required to have an outlet way out there to become a sort of a restaurant and shopping district area as they were walking. And all of a sudden, of course, it is in California, so they have wonderful climate, and they have mountains nearby, and they have ocean nearby, and they have a university there. So they have all of these influx of new kids and all of that. They literally have became then one of the happiest places. People rank themselves the happiest there because of the lifestyle that they get. And they'll take a 40% decrease in money just to live there because they like it so much. Hmm. But they were way ahead of the walkability curve. You know, when people started talking about that in the, you know, 20 years ago, they were 40 years ago that they started doing this. And it takes a generation to change a little, even a small town like that. And, you know, so now this place is... They create happier people. Sure. People like to go there. They like to live there. This is how, it's not magic. It right. is just simply, we're going to have the will to change. We're going to see this as our vision. And every place is different, you know, because every climate is different. The topography is different. The jobs are different. The people, the culture, the things that people care about. But they have to come together like we were talking about earlier, Aruba did, to determine what they wanted to be because they saw they had an end of the line sort of struggle with energy and tourism. How do they then create a new generative future for themselves? And they all pitched in because they were yeah. bought in. And so that was a combination of vision and community development.
Well, and again, that's back, you know, the type of work you're doing is the lessons learned from San Luis Obispo can help Aruba as long as they utilize their own authenticity, their own set
That's
of values, their own set
do.
Of what they're trying to do. We can all learn from each other in terms of how we got there, but that sort of back to that hyper-localism, maybe that's the secret sauce in becoming a great place or remaining a great place to
well,
be.
Let's talk about that planning process. Work. So here's the planning process we created. The planning process says you have to go through this master planning process, right? And we're going to meet at this time in this place. And if you aren't there, too bad. Well, instead, if the communities are figuring out when they're going to meet, and where they're going to meet, instead of having to come to City Hall and take off their evening of work and sit around and waiting for their item to come up on the agenda and missing it and having to come back the next night and leaving, you know, getting babysitters and everything else that they have to do to make that happen, it's a very inconvenient process.
Absolutely.
We know as professionals, eventually we're going to win whatever battles we have there because we're getting paid. We're never going to miss a meeting.
Right.
They're going to have some, you know, sick kid or something. They aren't going to be there and we're going to pass something. They aren't going to win. You know, that's the way that whole system makes it right. very difficult for them. What they did in Aruba
we wind up overcompensating for those three or four people who do sit in the front row
mm-hmm.
and complain about everything.
They do.
You know, the concept of over-serving in business. If you have a client that gives you
the
$20 million
wheel.
A year, then you're giving them the special treatment and somebody comes in once in a while, maybe they'll get a hello or a Christmas card or something. It's the exact opposite at City Hall. The three or four people that come in and complain get all the attention
yeah.
and the working families and the single mothers and everybody else is out there that can't possibly have
attend.
The time
yeah,
to
they
come
don't
downtown that your whole future depends upon
mm-hmm.
never get engaged in the process.
That's
it's,
right.
it's the reverse.
Yeah, and
it's
so we have to redesign our processes from that point of view. If we ever really want to do what Aruba did, now San Luis Obispo used the normal process. They just happened to have a visionary leader.
Okay.
So they circumvented what Aruba found, which was how do you develop from the grassroots up?
Right.
And the grassroots, I think, is a more substantial, robust process because you can duplicate it. It's that appreciative inquiry process and foresight processes are known. Depending that you're going to have a visionary mayor that's going to stick around for a generation and get something pushed through is a different formula,
right.
you know, and happens, but it's more rare.
Right.
And so do you want to create, and I think in Michigan, you should think about creating networks of prosperous cities, not just one happy city, but make it spread so that it's a whole happy state. I mean, why would you stop with just one village at a time? Why would you just say, I'm just taking care of us, that's all I care about? Again, it's a fragmentation mentality. How do you join it together so all the boats are higher?
Well, it's fascinating work, looking at the future, trying to figure out how we all individually and collectively deal with that. Dr. Cindy Fruin, thank you very much for being here. As if folks are interested and they want to find out more about your work, where can they go to find you on the web? Or
Yeah, sure. So I have a website. I haven't been as active as I used to be. I was a very active blogger. I now do a lot of parent care that is very time consuming, I have to say.
Well,
I
blogs
have a real...
on your list earlier, blogs are sort of going by the wayside.
People I know, that's right. Is it? And so I have, and that's at UrbanVerse on Twitter and UrbanVerse.net on the web, or LinkedIn, Cindy Fruin is probably that really gets to me. You get to me quickest that way.
Great. Well, thanks for being with us today. I know the 60 or so local leaders here listening to your talk today about where things may be going. And certainly as we look at demographic changes and climate changes and business changes and governmental changes, we didn't get much into that, but we see that craziness happening as well
it
from
really
a
is.
Democratic perspective, a small d Democratic perspective. How we move forward. So thank you very much for being with us, and look forward to following you into the future.
Yeah.
And checking to make sure you're right.
And I'm very excited about your Future Cities series that you have going on. It's a really brilliant idea.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
This has been a production of the Michigan Municipal League. For more information on our programs and services, please visit www.mml.org and join us for the next episode of We Love Where You Live.